Thank you for the warm introduction. And I'm very honored to be here. When Molly asked me to come, I accepted. And it's just been a wonderful experience to be here. A little bit of my background, I didn't share why I'm a dual national. Even though I'm a dual national, I'm not planning to run for president, so don't worry at the end of this talk. My mother was born in Portland, Oregon. My dad was born in Montreal. We have Lebanese ancestry on both sides. Probably one of the reasons I'm so tough is because of my background, because the Lebanese have survived lots of wars, Turkish persecution. My grandparents were Christians and left under persecution, being Christians and under very dire conditions prior to the First World War. My parents met and married in Walla Walla, Washington, and my mother at a very young age moved to Montreal, so that was quite an adaptation for her. My talk is on, as a physician, why I refuse to kill my patients. I am a family physician. I've been involved in a court battle now for 4 years with the Canadian and Quebec governments. I'm still waiting to have my case be heard. The government has used every procedural manner to keep my case from being heard in court. It's cost me tens of thousands of dollars. Just to warn you that once a law is passed, it's extremely difficult to reverse the flow to the point that you won't even be allowed to present your arguments, not only in the public arena, but in the courts. And the courts are supposed to be your last opportunity to speak. This here is a ad that we ran just prior to the passing of the law in French and English and a major publication. And it asks if someone you love was put to death without their consent. I'm going to show you in this talk that this idea of voluntary consent is a hoax. And the pro-euthanasia assisted suicide people have been promoting that. They say, well, it's okay if the person agrees to it. And you'll be seeing the statistics that, in fact, this is not true. This is a painting by a Spanish artist at the turn of the century, Barro. And it's a story that many of you probably heard in Sunday school, of the story of the Good Samaritan. And the story, as recorded in the Gospel of Luke, describes how a man was left half dead at the side of the road, and many people of society were too busy to stop by and give him medical aid. We're not talking about medical aid in dying, but medical aid, true medical aid. And that's really what compassionate care is. You heard the group called compassionate care. That's killing a person is not compassionate care. The man on the side of the road did not give poison. Poison was available in the time of Christ and the Romans. In fact, Seneca, who was a Roman philosopher, stated that it was noble to take poison if you were sick, if you were feeble-minded, and if you were a burden to society. So it was part of Roman culture to give poison and to take poison. As you know, the story goes on to describe how he bound up the wounds with wine and oil, took the man who was left half dead. It's described in the Gospel of Luke as a man half dead, so he would have fitted many of today's criteria for assisted suicide or euthanasia. And then said that whatever care more he needs after he stayed overnight, the next day he left, he said, I'll provide for it. There was no talk of rationalization of resources. That's a big talk today. We have to save money. And then only those who we can afford to care for will we care for. There was no discussion by the Good Samaritan. My commitment is to heal and not to kill. And this is really is what all civilized societies for centuries have practiced. The model they've used is that of the Judeo-Christian ethic of caring for those who are disabled, who are sick, and need care. In the law in Canada and Quebec particular, in Canada it hasn't been decided, because the Quebec would be like the state of Ohio, it's province, Then there's the Canadian government, which oversees also health care. In the law where I'm practicing presently, I'm not obligated to euthanize. Euthanasia, which you don't have here in the United States, is where you provide a lethal injection like you do with people on death row. You give an injection, you make sure they're dead, and they die quickly. But I'm obligated to referral. For me, referral is like writing a prescription and knowing that the person that you refer the person will kill that person. Nuremberg principles show that referral is equivalent to participating in euthanasia and makes one as guilty as someone who commits euthanasia. And I want to emphasize that some people believe that because they won't sign up for assisted suicide euthanasia, it doesn't affect them or their families. I'm going to show you how it does. Presently, there are about 7 countries, including Australia, but in Australia it's only 1 out of 6 states and 2 territories that has the law, so it's only 1/8 of the country. Belgium, Canada, Colombia, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and Switzerland. You say, well, that's not too many countries, and that's nothing to worry about. But the pro-euthanasia people, pro-assisted suicide is where the physician writes the prescription, as they do in the United States, and the person goes home and takes the lethal ingestion. Usually it's a large number of barbiturate pills. In the United States presently, there are only 6 states where it's legal. Montana, people have to go to the court and have to fight, and it's a special situation. But just so that, again, you're not reassured, these are the states, there are about 20 states this year which are trying to pass assisted suicide laws. Many of them were presented last year. Included in these states is the state of Ohio, and the bill is SB 249. On the other side of the handout, I've given some very basic information. On the other side, it actually gives the name of the bill so that you can work with your organizations to fight this. It's very important to fight in every state, wherever you're involved or where you're living. I won't go through my history. That's already been done. But presently, I work with patients who are chronically disabled with severe neurological disease, many of them on ventilators. And there's been lots of discussion in the care of these patients about rationalization of resources, and physicians who expend too much money or too much time are criticized and risk losing their ability to practice in that care unit. Why should we care for these people? The reason we should care is because, as my 8-year-old daughter, and you'll see a video of her soon, describes each of us as being part of humankind. I briefly spoke to you about the Quebec law. It was passed in 2014 in Canada. It was passed in 2016. And I've been battling both governments, even to the point where the Prime Minister of Canada spoke publicly to the public and had the Attorney General switch sides to go against because the government, I was able to stop the law successfully for 2 weeks. And then the Prime Minister stepped in and had the Attorney General, I don't know if this would have passed in the United States, but the Attorney General switched sides and said, we were for Dr. Saba, now we're against him over a period of 2 weeks. But we're not changing our position. We're just saying that we're taking completely opposite position, but we stand by what we said before, but now we're against it. So they basically speaking on both sides of their mouth. So that's considered progressive. Just to let you know how things will advance, people say there's no such thing as slippery slope. Since they say you can't use the word slippery slope, I don't use slippery slope. I just call it expansion. The Belgian legislature proposed extending the law to children. At that point, our family did a video letter to the King of Belgium. And I will show that to you in a minute. Why were we concerned? Because Quebec was already talking about extending the Quebec human rights to children even after the passage of the law. And now we have in Canada, in December of this year, a committee will be presenting proposals to extend euthanasia not only to children, but also to purely depressed and people with memory loss. And this was done 4 years ago, and I just want to show that to you.
My name is Dr. Paul Saba. I'm a family physician who practices family medicine in Lachine, Quebec, Canada. I want to appeal to you, Your Majesty, as King of Belgium, not to sign the law extending euthanasia to children. In Canada, they are planning to pass a euthanasia law here in Quebec, where I live. And this will have an impact eventually on our children. If you sign your law, euthanasia will be extended not only to children in your country, but also to the children of the world. What started off with adults is now being extended to children. We cannot allow this to happen. There are millions of children born every year with congenital malformations, including our daughter, Jessica. Jessica was born with a severe cardiac malformation. If she was born in a country where euthanasia is permitted, she could have been euthanized. That was 4 years ago.
Baby girl. Little baby girl. Oh. Oh, mommy. Oh. I chewed it.
When I first saw Jessica a few hours after she was born, they were about to take her over to the children's. And I remember the first thing I told her was, "You fight, little girl, you fight." And that's exactly what she did. And she's been doing that ever since.
Hi, Angel. Hi, sweet Angel.
At 6 days, she underwent emergency cardiac interventions to dilate her closed valve, and eventually her heart, which was only partially formed, started to grow. When she was 5 weeks old, she was able to leave the hospital.
I'm glad to be taking her home.
We have definitely had difficult times, but I thank God for the outcome, that she's alive and that she's doing well.
She's now 4 years old, has an older brother, John Anthony, and sister, Eliana.
Jessica, my little sister, who had heart problems and had to have surgery, is very energetic and is a really great sister.
I love Jessica. She makes me laugh. Jessica's the best because she's funny. Jessica's the best because she likes to play with my toys. Jessica's the best because she doesn't snore.
Some people may not have the same support and resources as we did, seeing that we have the medical background. They may also give up too early and just accept the euthanasia of the child as being their only solution, when in reality, it is not.
For the sake of the children of the world, please do not sign the euthanasia law.
Please do not sign the euthanasia law for the sake of the children.
This, my wife is here. Marissa, would you stand up and just say hi to everybody? I think people often think of euthanasia-assisted suicide as somebody at the end of the road, right at the end, and the pro-euthanizers often talk about, well, it's only if people only have a few days, few weeks to live. But as you can see in my discussion, they keep extending it to more, to people have months to years to live, and you can't always predict who's going to live, and they extend it back to children, so that in Belgium, Holland, now they're doing it to children and newborns. It's a continuum from birth to older age. Every life is valuable. This is a painting that my daughter did this past year. I said, Jessica, honey, draw a picture of our family. She did this, and at the top of the painting, she wrote this herself, "Made to Live." So this is really her testimony, and she's doing great. Right from the beginning, my wife has a story where we're constantly being harassed to abort her. We were told she had no quality of life. She was going to be a Down syndrome child, that she had severe defects. And what type of parents were we to bring a child with all these defects into the world and that she would have no quality of life? So you can see it's a constant battle. And she wasn't born with Downs. We're thankful for that. But every child is valuable, whether they have Downs or not. We struggled with the cardiac, and we went through a lot with the cardiac malformations, and we're very sick. The children were amazing. I wanted to say that the reason as physician, we don't take, you know, I don't like to use the word taking an oath, because even the Bible says don't swear by anything. But we're committed, I'm committed as a physician to the Hippocratic Oath. And it's really the Hippocratic Oath modern day is really the Good Samaritan model of care, caring for people who are less well off. Hippocrates was a physician who practiced 2,500 years ago. That model and the Judeo-Christian model of the Good Samaritan are really in the way medicine has been practiced until recently, where we say that I commit not to give any deadly medicine to anyone if asked, and I will do everything for the benefit of my patients, and I will do no harm to my patients. The slide that I show you next is a slide of children in a concentration camp. People are said, do not talk about euthanasia, what happened in Germany, because that has nothing to do with modern day. But it does, because the Frankl, who was a survival, said that it's really the concept. I'm talking about the philosophical context in which euthanasia has been adopted. He wrote that the gas chambers of Auschwitz would have never happened if it were not for the philosophy of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. And there were two German professors, Binding a Jurist, Hotch, a psychiatrist, who wrote a book in the 1920s called The Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life. This was published in Germany, and it really set the groundwork for euthanasia. They considered unworthy of life those who were sick, feeble-minded, deformed children, retarded. And they even used the term, they described euthanasia as death assistance, which is the term we use today. There were a few who stood up and spoke against it. There was a Catholic priest who spoke out and gave many sermons. He was targeted by Hitler and Goring to be killed, but because he spoke out so strongly, they were afraid he was very popular. There was also Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Me being a Protestant, I focus on some more Protestant, but there were Catholic priests also who spoke out. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. So we are responsibility to act. He was... he helped Jews escape. He worked in the resistance. He was executed by Adolf Hitler, the Gestapo, on April 9th, 1945. There was a New England Journal article written by Leo Alexander, who was a Secretary of War consultant in the Nuremberg trials. This was a famous article in which he's described that the acceptance of euthanasia came because of physicians who said that certain life was less worthy to be lived. He described this, the rational utility of Hegelian philosophy. The Nuremberg trials, which you see here in this photo, basically indicted as war criminals people who acquiesced, not only who did euthanasia, but also those who endorsed or referred or acquiesced. And individuals could not argue as a legal defense following superior orders or acting because it was an act of state. This was principle four. And in the same way, the World Medical Association has told physicians not to practice euthanasia in jurisdictions where it is legally permitted. Getting back to the philosophical context of euthanasia-assisted suicide, the model which I show here is, you see the Titanic sinking. This, I believe, was in 1912. And there were lots of people didn't survive because there weren't enough lifeboats. And Tom Koch, a Canadian bioethicist, said that according to the neoliberal concept, society only has limited resources, like a limited number of lifeboats on the sinking Titanic, and only those who can survive to get in the boat should get in the boats. That's the thinking today. The fact is, if the ship owners hadn't been so greedy and provided enough lifeboats, most of those people would have survived today. So today we're really prioritizing money over life. Do we accept the Good Samaritan model to help people despite their means or our means, or do we believe in life? This is a propaganda photo from the Second World War by the Nazis. And in it, it says the person suffering from hereditary defects cost the community 60,000 Reichsmarks during their lifetimes. Fellow Germans, that is your money. So the thinking today is rationalization of resources. We haven't changed much from the German thinking. Often euphemisms are used to market death, dying with dignity, compassionate choices, medical aid in dying. Physicians have been co-opted to do this. They're required to kill. If a doctor kills, then it's medical. It can't be wrong. Surveys are skewed, polls. They ask people, if a person has a horrendous suffering, would you support it? You know, and they don't really say that with palliative care you can alleviate the suffering. So people sign up, yes, because that's all they can think. We've got to stop the suffering. We co-opt the victim. We call it a voluntary act. We legalize it. So if it's legal, the government says okay, it must be okay. We glamorize it. You see these glamorous deaths of people with the family around them holding their hand or their loved one. You have lobbying by pro-assisted suicide groups. There's apathy by the public. People will say it doesn't concern me. I'm going to show you it does concern you because it will concern one day maybe a member of your family or a friend who's depressed or a child. There's apathy by the church. When I try to get signatures from Protestant evangelical as well as Catholic churches, because I figured that these people would be those who are most opposed to killing, we approached 100 churches, only 10 allowed us to get signatures. We weren't asking for money. Many of the times they said, we're not political. There's a falsification of numbers. They'll describe only a small handful. In Quebec last year, there were 638 euthanasia. The Minister of Health, prior to the law, said, I can't imagine more than a small handful, at most 25. So they try to minimize the numbers. They use extreme language. They describe horrible, agonizing deaths if you don't allow for it. They make false claims, saying that I was on one radio interview and a guy called in. He said, I'd rather that we euthanize than have some poor kids scared by somebody jumping off a bridge. They falsify certainty. They say doctors must know when a person's going to die in 6 months. I'm going to show you that there's a 50% error rate. Diagnostic errors. Oh, well, for sure the person has cancer is going to die. 10 to 20% error rates there. Attacking opponents. If you're against euthanasia, then you're for suffering. I hear people say, oh, those Catholics, they're for suffering. Of course they're against it. Falsely identify. And then as a Protestant, say, well, I'm a Protestant, I'm not Catholic, so that doesn't hold. So I'm sorry I don't defend you the Catholics better than that. Falsely identifying assisted suicide or euthanasia as progressive. And as I'm saying now, they're talking about extending it in Canada to children, and the press is being studied by the Canadian Parliamentary Committee. Children as young as 11 or 12, the Ontario Advisory Committee is saying without parental consent that children should be allowed to make the decision. And this is, you can look up these facts on the internet. Case of Nadine illustrates the consequence of enacting such a provision. She was 14 years old a few years back. She's now 20 with an aggressive form of leukemia, underwent multiple chemotherapies and a failed bone marrow transplant. She was ready to give up and opted to die. A bioethicist in Canada said children like that, and he didn't speak about her, he didn't know about her, should have the right to die after two or three failed chemotherapies. Here's a bit of her story here. I'm having a hard time. Sorry about that. Right here. Right on the button. Okay, here we go. We lost. Okay, that's fine.
I'm sorry. Right.
It's all right. Even mature children don't have the ability to reason. For example, driving, voting, entering into civil contracts, and yet they'll be permitted to be euthanized. Here's a story. This is another story. This is a 5-year-old Jolianne Sylvain Shirley. Just briefly tell you her story. This young girl. Parents, young couple, was told prior to being birthed, very similar to our story, that the child probably had Downs, had a defective esophagus. They advised to abort. They refused. She was born with a defective esophagus, didn't have Downs. After multiple surgery, she did well. And then her mother, a few years later, was in coma from a severe pneumonia with multiple myeloma. After 20 days on the ventilator, her husband, who's my patient, and herself, who's my patient, he called me, says, what should I do, doctor? They want to pull the plug. I says, hold on, make sure she gets the best medical care. She survived. Today, Sylvain says he'd be alone without the two women he loved most if he had listened to his doctors. I'm going to quickly go through this, but to emphasize that presently, UN conventions opposes euthanasia of children. I'm not saying that won't change because there's lots of political pressure. As you know, the UN can be easily influenced. They say that children need adequate medical services. We've got to prevent them from cruelty. They deserve the best in health care, including high-quality palliative care. The International World Congress on Pediatric Palliative Care said that euthanasia is not part of children's palliative care, and the answer to the suffering is better palliative care and not the ending of a child's life. I'll talk to you briefly what palliative care is. I spoke to you that I'm in the court since 2014. I insist that euthanasia is not a medical care, that the local legislature doesn't have the right to say what is medical care. It goes against our code of ethics. It's impossible for people at the end of life to make proper consent, and it goes against Canadian laws. As I've said already, none of those arguments have been heard yet because I've been just involved in procedural delays by both governments. In fact, they say that Dr. Saba has the same proportional means as both governments, and that the court shouldn't help me in my fight. So they're saying I'm as rich as the government. Maybe if Donald Trump was in the fight, we could say it's true, but in my case, I can assure it's not. This is one of my patients, Mona Latour, who in 2007 was told she only had a few months to live, and she was ready to opt for euthanasia. I'm going to try to do a better job here this time here.
Quebec's euthanasia law could be facing a legal challenge. The doctor leading the charge says too many patients are being misdiagnosed. He stresses the focus should be on providing better care and treatment for patients. Navneet Paul met the doctor and some patients to hear out their concerns.
The opposition to Quebec's medical aid in dying law have not given up.
After Bill 2, which gives patients access to doctor-assisted dying, was upheld by the Quebec Court of Appeal last winter, a family doctor is challenging the law.
The government is putting money ahead of lives.
Dr. Paul Saba is planning on challenging the law in Quebec's Superior Court, and if necessary, he is ready to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. He argues the medical field is filled with errors in diagnosis and prognosis, and too often patients are making the difficult choice of dying on erroneous facts.
The government's really been pushing, promoting this as this is kind of an autonomy issue. But what is the autonomy issue and self-decision when you have all these errors that the population hasn't been made aware of?
These patients of Saba agree with his perspective. They, or loved ones, have all been diagnosed with terminal diseases. But then, at some point, they were either misdiagnosed or the prognosis was all wrong.
Let's say it would have been available when I was diagnosed. I would have thought of it, seriously, because the lung specialist that I had told me I didn't have long to live anyway, so why suffer?
Mona Latour Bourque was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. That was 9 years ago. She sought a second opinion and is glad she did.
If I would have chose to die, I would have given up 9 years. I see my grandson who's 9 years old. I get emotional. I have a granddaughter who's 16 months. I wouldn't have seen him.
Latour Bourque is not the only one taking advantage of a second lease on life. Mario Bazzocchi's wife, Jeanette, recently passed away. When she was diagnosed with cancer, doctors initially gave her 6 months to live. She ended up living for another 6 years.
I don't think that people necessarily, because they get treatment or, you know, get diagnosed for something specifically, right away that they should jump into, okay, now I have a choice, either I suffer or I do this. You know? No, you should go through the process.
Saba says he is expecting to file a court challenge this week. Navneet Paul, Global News, Montreal.
I described a little bit of why we cannot accept this for physicians. We change the paradigm of doctor. The healer becomes the executioner. I showed you a little bit before that the physicians were refusing to do this. 88% of palliative care physicians said no. And in fact, in Quebec, they're having a hard time to find doctors. They only have a few handful that are willing to do this. In polls, there's confusion. Even doctors don't know the difference between euthanasia and the palliative care. And this was published in the Canadian Medical Journal. We have an obligation, as this the Code of Ethics of Quebec represents pretty much all of the codes internationally, where we have a responsibility to protect and promote health and well-being, practice according to the best scientific principles, not do anything to endanger the safety of people. And, of course, I'm showing you that it is dangerous to people's lives, misdiagnosis and prognosis and pressures. It's not the best, highest standard of medical care. Palliative care is. And we need to provide palliative care when people are really at the end of life, which is in 70% of cases is not available to Canadians, and I'm sure in the United States too. The World Health Organization says it's a fundamental right to provide palliative care, to provide pain treatment, and to provide the best standards of care, which euthanasia does not. The palliative care does not include the practice of euthanasia according to international norms. And this was stated by the International Association of Hospice and Palliative Care. I've already said to you the World Health, which represents 9 million doctors in 100 countries, says that euthanasia, which is a deliberate act of ending someone's life, even if it's requested, does not and should not be practiced, and doctors should refuse. And that's what I'm declaring in my court challenge. Often people say civilized societies, modern progressive societies, have euthanasia-assisted suicide, like Belgium or Netherlands or Canada. Well, the United Kingdom, Scotland, and France have recently rejected legislation because of its dangers to its citizens. And unless you're anti-French or anti-British, you cannot say that these are not civilized societies. And as I'm showing my court challenge, everyone talks about the choice and personal choice and autonomy. This contravenes free informed consent. As I said, 70% of people don't have access to palliative care, so if they don't have the option, they're being forced to make a decision to have their pain and suffering cared for. There's errors in prognosis, whether it's cancer or chronic lung or heart disease. It's like flipping a coin, saying who's going to die over the next 6 months. Errors in diagnosis, published in JAMA, 10 to 20%. And for fatal diagnosis, it's 5%. This is the last video I'm going to show you. My patient, Alexander Matroy. Actually, I'm going to skip that because we don't have time. He had lung cancer surgery at 54, and it turned out that he didn't actually have lung cancer but a fungal infection. And he would have opted in his testimony. Actually, let's show it. I think it's very powerful. Let's just show that. If you can just close the lights, we'll show that. And then we'll come to the end of our... There we go.
And thank you for joining us. A Montreal physician is challenging both the provincial and federal medical aid laws in dying. He says they are dangerous. He cites medical errors for patients with lung cancer and chronic disease, and says many patients feel the laws are wrong as well. Here's Amanda Klein.
Dr. Paul Saba has been battling medical aid in dying since before it was a law.
But with improved medical care, she is happy to be alive today.
He says misdiagnosis is one of the many examples why dying with the help of a physician should be illegal.
And it's 10 to 20%, depending on what studies you look at. And we're talking about serious diagnostic errors, enough that in the United States would lead to medical malpractice.
Alexandre Montreuil was misdiagnosed with lung cancer in 2004. He says if medical aid in dying was available to him then, he would have wanted the injection.
I had a couple of friends that went through it. I didn't want to go there at all. You know, if it wasn't from that little doctor, I would have said goodbye to this world.
In Canada, the law allowing for medical aid in dying passed just last month. In Quebec, the law passed back in December. And since then, 166 Quebecers have died with the help of a physician.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. As I said, often the arguments used include rationalization of resources. There's a danger of elder abuse. I've sat at meetings where people who are responsible for their loved ones have to be removed because they're abusing them financially. What greater abuse than having the person's life ended so they could inherit the wealth? There's also, depends on the physician. Some doctors won't put you in an intensive care because they think you have little chance of survival. And studies have shown that if your doctor is overly, there's pessimism versus optimism, pessimistic, you're more likely to die, not get admitted to intensive care. He just feels that you're not going to make it anyway, so why waste money? Sir Winston Churchill said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Voltaire said, those who make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And one of the biggest absurdities is that you can make assisted suicide safe, and that people can really have real, make autonomous decisions. So these are all illusions. So we get people to believe these crazy things, and that the only way to relieve suffering is to kill people. These are absurdities. I mentioned 638 people died last year. 31 cases did not respect the law. In Quebec Superior Court a couple months ago, the Attorney General of Canada and Quebec said that that was only a small number and that wasn't important. If in the United States you injected accidentally 31 people in the state of Ohio, I don't think you have capital punishment here, do you? But if you do, yeah. If you accidentally injected those on death row and they really weren't guilty, I think there would be a major outcry. In Belgium, 32% of cases in a study in JAMA did not, the patients or the family did not consent, and almost half the cases went unreported. In Oregon, 20% of depressed people get assisted suicide without seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist. In Quebec, there is no mandatory requirement for depressed people to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist before they're injected. There's a real danger that this will be expanded. I spoke to you about what's happening in Belgium and the Netherlands. In Belgium, 2003, there were 235 deaths, and there were 2012 and 2015. They did two twins because they were told they might have progressive blindness. An elderly couple went together so they couldn't be left alone because of exhaustion of living. In Belgium, and if you look at a British medical journal under euthanasia, they did 35 cases of purely depressed people with autism. In the Netherlands, 42 people in the British medical journal. No underlying medical condition, no heart disease, no cancer, just depressed. And Tom Mortier, who is a professor and came to Montreal in 2012, spoke about his mother on the bottom of the screen, who was euthanized because she was depressed. One psychiatrist was opposed to it, one was for it, the other one wasn't sure, but they went ahead and euthanized her anyway. He didn't get any redress in the Belgian court, so he's before the European Court of Human Rights. A 24-year-old woman was given the right to be euthanized in 2015 in Belgium. I ascertain to you there's lots of reasons a depressed person can't make a free and informed decision, including sense of helplessness and hopelessness. We did a video. I won't show this, but the doctor and psychologist speak against it. People need palliative care, including for end-of-life care. 70% of Canadians don't have it. What is palliative care? Palliative care is this: not giving pain medications, but it's giving people support at the end of life. If they're wrong, because we have a palliative care service at our hospital, 5 beds, it's going to be increased to 10. Every year, 5 people walk out. They're supposed to die within 3 months, and they live sometimes for more months or years later. Once you've got the injection, you don't have that second chance. And it's described for people with life-threatening illness, not only pain treatment, but physical, psychosocial, and social support. And studies have shown people are happier. So if you have a chronic disease, you just don't get needles till you die for the pain. You get a little pain, you can still get your chemotherapy, you're still your treatment. It's not just, some hospitals, obviously, and hospice centers have taken the attitude that if you're in a palliative care, you should be rushed out and die. But that's not true palliative care. And the classic study in 2010 New England Journal showed that people even with small lung cell cancer lived 3 months longer while they were being treated and got palliative care. Conclusion. Euthanasia-assisted suicide is not the solution for people at the end of life or people who are suffering. People should be cared for and not killed. There's errors in diagnosis, prognosis. If we have these laws in place, it discriminates against depressed, the children, those with chronic conditions, disabled, and the poor. Therefore, we must do everything to stop these laws and, where the laws exist, to oppose them. And as I mentioned, there are about 25 states in the United States every year where these laws are being proposed. And what can we do? You can go to my website. I have that information on the handout. We have a fund to help in the legal cost. I have a Facebook page. I can friend you there. I'm not quite sure how to do that. My daughter will show me how to do that. Speak to friends and family. Join local organizations like this one here in Ohio and the other ones that are out in the all the different tables out there. Write, meet your state representative senators. They say for every person who writes, I think it represents 100 votes. And every time you meet a representative, it represents about 1,000 votes. I missed the last talk, so I'm not sure if he corroborated that. invite speakers to your communities, educate them about danger. So that not only to your communities, but also your church. And there's also a coalition website. And I'm not going to tell you to contribute, because I already told you that before. My wife says, don't say that twice. It sounds like you're grabbing money. Okay, good. Time for questions. Thank you.